Group Summer School, Thursday afternoon, 24th June 1982. This is the first question. Will you talk briefly about prayer and its relevance to the religious life? When man begins to be aware of something which is the immensity, something much greater than him, something which fills him with awe and a feeling of reverence in addition, he tends to produce prayers. He recognizes that power as the power which, or at least he imagines that that power which he senses is the power which gives him life and everything that is necessary for him, controls him, controls the world, the universe, and so on. So we have, on the one hand, we have what we commonly call petitionary prayer. That is, asking for something for oneself. Something in the, not in the sense in which a child asks its parent to bring this, that, or the other toy, but in the sense of something which will fulfill his life, will certainly bring about the necessities of existence, take care of him, protect him, and so on. And that petitionary prayer probably extends later on to intercessionary prayer, prayer for the sake of his family, his friends, his tribe, and so on. So, to that degree, petitionary and intercessionary prayer is related to the religious experience, the religious feeling, and the religious life. There is then the other aspect, namely that prayer consists of hymns of praise, hymns of devotion, hymns of recognition, a deep inward recognition of that which is divine. And insofar as the person expresses his devotion and that praise is an expression of his inward recognition that this power is something very real and so forth, it becomes prayer in a different sense from petitionary prayer. Also, prayer is associated with bringing about a state of calm and peace within oneself. If one is in inward distress, deep inward distress, not merely for material reasons or just superficially emotional reasons, but deep down within oneself there is questioning, there is confusion, there is fear, and so on, then the tendency is to pray for the solution of those problems and difficulties, to protect a loved one or something like that. And again, when each person observes and considers the flow of thought and feeling in his daily life, he will see how often that flow of thought and feeling consists of fantasies which are evil running through a brain. fantasies of hate, destruction, revenge, and so on. It's very easy to feel that, quite easy, even in so-called civilized, advanced people. And under such conditions, the situation becomes so intolerable to oneself and hurtful to one's good opinion of oneself that one can take recourse to prayers and hymns and so on. They have a calming effect. But, of course, one must remember that the ultimate solution of such things lies right within oneself. People often say that, oh, my prayers were answered. I do believe in a God who answers prayers. The psychical atmosphere is filled with the formal religious feelings of one's society. And that society may be a very large multitude. And the collective psychical atmosphere, therefore, has a certain amount of energy, like capital in a bank, which one can draw upon. So that prayer can bring about a response from that store of psychical energy in the atmosphere. And that is why a good result is obtained when the person prays. Of course, the person thinks that God, whatever his particular projection of God may be, has answered his prayer. But as far as I am aware, which is not very much, but still, as far as I am aware, there is no individual God who answers prayers. He's so busy doing his business that he doesn't bother about the noise of the earth. However, the fact that results are obtained strengthens the religious feel, meaning thereby a sense of that which is the immensity, the source, the transcendence itself. Call it God, call it Brahman, call it anything you like. But there is that which is other than what our senses convey to us as sources of power, energy, healing, and so on. Then there is the art of prayer. You will find in the Heart of Religion something written about that, page 263. How to pray in the deep sense. And if one does that, you can get some very extraordinary results. Now, the next question is, would you say that the Old Testament can best be understood by knowledge and workings of the Kabbalah? And the second question emphasizes that by saying, can only be understood by knowledge of the Kabbalah. Yes, I definitely do think that the really deep understanding of the Old Testament is helped by knowledge and workings of the Kabbalah, because the Kabbalah really gives the key to the way in which the Old Testament has been written. Even the Hebrew in which the Old Testament is written is not a wholly adequate translation of the original Kabbalistic teachings. As far as we know historically, it was Abraham who, going westwards in obedience to the divine call which he felt, took the Kabbalistic teachings with him. He went westwards towards Canaan. Now, the Kabbalistic teachings have been written in the Hebrew language in terms of what is called the letter number code. Each letter of the alphabet, the Hebrew letters, they stand for numbers starting from 1 to 9. Aleph is 1, Beth is 2, Gimel is 3, and so on. You see? And each of these letters and numbers are associated with, they represent profound metaphysical concepts, which are the result of deep insight obtained through the practice of meditation in the deep sense, in the true sense, by the original founders of this system. The letter number system is called the Gematria. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Gematria? Is that correct? You see? It's called the Gematria. Now, if you read the Old Testament in the Hebrew characters, you will find that each letter has its particular number. And when you have got all the numbers together, you get almost in a sentence, you get a whole philosophy, an extraordinary teaching. And you must remember also that each of the letters of the alphabet, Aleph, say, is already composed of the first letter, the Lam, is it? Lam? Lamed, yes, that's right. And that's it, you see. So that it's an extraordinarily complex system. But it is not a complicated system. If it were complicated, it would be just a mess. But it's a very complex system. Complex in the sense that, say, a Bach fugue is a very complex composition. Now, if one understands these and knows, has the key to the significance of the letters and numbers, which stand for these deep metaphysical concepts, then the Old Testament becomes something quite extraordinary. The original Veda of India also had that kind of system attached to it. And I believe, I have no special grounds for the belief, but I have the feeling that the original Veda and the Kabbalah both originated somewhere in the Euphrates-Tigris region. The one went eastwards towards India, the other went westwards towards what is now Palestine and so forth. So if one knows these things and can get the real key to it all, the genuine key, then the Old Testament is certainly a wonderful source of spiritual wisdom and, of course, psychological wisdom, because the scriptures of the world purport, and they do, tell you your own psychology and psychological development, purification and development, and they also relate that to the different states of consciousness you will go through in this psychological development. You see, as the psyche becomes purified, the mode of awareness which you have undergoes changes, until finally there is the supreme enlightenment. And in that supreme enlightenment, you see, all words are troublesome. When you say enlightenment, the idea of light and so forth, something astonishing, something shining, it's not like that. You become truly conscious in the profoundest sense of the word. That is to say, as far as human beings can become like that. Because by virtue of our constitution, our psychophysical constitution, there are limits to what the human can realize. Christs and Buddhas and Moseses and Zarathustras and so on will be the ordinary people of humanity, provided we don't destroy ourselves before that happens. But it'll be a very, very long time indeed. You see? Does the Old Testament convey the idea of personal resurrection as commonly understood in the New Testament? I don't know. As you see, after all, I haven't studied the Bible from first page to the last. It would take me another 100 years before I could do that thoroughly, because it's so profound. I don't know whether the Old Testament conveys that. Paul, is there any sort of idea of personal resurrection?
I don't think so in the Bible, in the Old Testament. In the prayer book, the idea of some sort of resurrection does come in. That's later.
That's very interesting. Because it is Zarathustrianism which first put out the idea of resurrection, the rising of the dead, the last judgment, and all that sort of thing. The origin of all those teachings is in Zarathustrianism, and both Judaism and Christianity have this. What about Islam? Does anybody know whether Islam has the idea of resurrection? It has only paradise, I think, and a worldly paradise, but still very paradisical. Somewhat lackadaisical too. Now, what is the difference? This is the next question. What is the difference between mind and consciousness? Essentially, consciousness is mind lighted up. When you are, now we as we are, we receive impressions through our senses, and we also receive impressions by the uprising of memory and so forth within ourselves. You see? So those are the mental phenomena which we experience. But when any of that is truly lighted up and is absolutely clear, clear-sightedness, clear hearing, because one may translate one's experience not only in terms of seeing the truth of it, but hearing the truth of it, depending upon your particular constitution and your particular leaning, your bias in the nice sense of the right sense of the word. Not a bias, not as a prejudice, but that is your bent, as we say, you see. So consciousness is that lighted up activity of the activity of lighting up. The thing is fully understood, quite clear, no difficulty. Of course, in European languages, I think consciousness does not really convey things very clearly. That kind of word consciousness is so inadequately used. In Sanskrit, we have very clear distinctions between them. We have manas and chitta. And if one spoke those languages, one could have a sort of a better feel of the true meaning of the difference between them. The next question is as follows. In the midst of life, we are in death. This Bible quotation is often taken to mean that we know not the day or the hour when our life may suddenly end. Can it be that by seeing life as a process of growth and development spiritually, we also see that we die daily to the old self? And is this the real meaning of the Bible words? Well, I would, my own inclination would be to take that meaning as presented already, that by seeing life as a process of growth and development spiritually, we also see that we die daily to the old self. Because the whole process of manifestation, of procedure, of development, is a process of change. You see? Now, in order that this which holds good at this instant is to change, it means that this must die to its present state, its present condition, in order to become the new condition. That is the whole point, you see? So that we, looking at changes, we see them as the continuity of life. And we say that, oh, he's still alive and he's improving, getting on and growing and maturing and so forth. Well, it involves death from instant to instant. It is death which is the portal which opens in order that this may change into the new life, the new state. Death occurs both with regressive change and with progressive change, until there comes a final end, final not in the absolute sense, but in a relative sense. It's final for that particular species or that particular type of manifestation in the universal process. So that is a final end. I don't know whether the Bible quotation really means we know not the day or the hour when our life may suddenly end. In actual fact, even if one dies very peacefully and happily in bed or wherever it is that one dies, even there, the actual phenomenon of death is a sudden process. One moment, John Brown is alive. He takes in his last breath, as we say. Finished. The whole thing's ended. Completely. That's sudden, isn't it? Unless sudden has a different meaning. Has a time span.
Well, yes, in one of the prayers, I think it's a Catholic prayer.
Yes.
From they say, God save us from...
Yes.
Sudden death.
Save us from sudden death.
Yes.
But there is a reason for that. There's a very good reason. Preserve us from sudden death in case when death is approaching, and whenever death is approaching in the normal way, one is fully aware that I am going. And there is a feeling of resignation. Not resignation of the wrong sort, but the right sort of resignation. Right now, let this happen. And you will notice that so many people who have suffered great illness or something like that, but when the final death comes, the whole face is transformed and there is a peace that spreads into one, you see? Now, that is essential in order that absolution can take place. He'll die absolved. You see? That, I think that lies at the root of the Catholic. Any Catholics here? I think that lies at the root of it. So that you don't die without the priest being there to, you know, the last sacraments and the absolution. So that man dies in peace.
Yeah.
he feels that nothing terrible is going to happen to him after that. He dies in peace. Of course, you know what Voltaire said at his deathbed. On the one hand came the doctor, on the one side was the doctor, on the other side was the priest. And Voltaire said, "Now I can die like Christ between the two thieves." Now, this question: if the enlightenment of Jesus happened after the temptation in the wilderness, what then is the deep meaning of the crucifixion and the resurrection? Now, there are two points here on which I'm quite ignorant. Did the enlightenment take place after the temptation? I don't know. You see, this business of enlightenment, there are those who say enlightenment takes place just like that, suddenly. Yes, the actual final bursting out into light is a sudden thing. But it has been preceded by a long process of development, of growth, till the critical point is reached, and then that's it. You see? So people who emphasize that critical point say that enlightenment is sudden. I myself don't feel at all sympathetic to that idea, because it is the power of transcendence itself which is quietly working all the time. And if I, the individual, the ordinary person, am in line with that process and allow it to take place gradually, then after a considerable gradual growth, there is this sudden lighting up and one is enlightened. Now, I should imagine that with Jesus too, this process of enlightenment started long ago. I mean, the whole development, the purification, the deeper and deeper insight into reality, and then finally that final stage when in consciousness bursts out fully enlightened, literally lighted up. I mean, these things are extremely difficult to describe, but one can get the feel of it if one has experienced something of that sort at least sometime in one's life. And the wilderness, of course, is very significant indeed. We heard such excellent things this morning about this point about the wilderness. You know how, for instance, Moses is in Horeb, the wasteland. And this wasteland, I should imagine, sort of typifies the process of the dissolution of all the impedimenta which clog the psyche. That is the wasteland, and it's all going away. And then finally, when that process has gone far enough, perhaps very far, then suddenly the voice, there is the burning bush present, and the voice comes out of the burning bush and declares itself to be Yahweh Elohim. That is in the case of Moses, you see. And Moses is enlightened then, really. He's in the what I have called in the heart of religion, the I am state. The Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. That is the complete, what in Christian terms we call the complete Unio Mystica. Now, what then is the deep meaning of the crucifixion and the resurrection? I think we had a really fine exposition of crucifixion this morning. And the resurrection, the rising up. You know how St. Paul says in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, what is sown in corruption rises up incorruptible. I think it's just before that, or maybe after, I forget now, there is the verse which says, what is sown as a what dies as a mortal body rises up as a spiritual body. Now, you know how I have presented it as this primordial creative energy, because the ultimate power or God or whatever you like to name it is creative energy. Everyone ascribes creative power first and foremost to the Supreme, to the Absolute, to the Ultimate. Creative power. This creative energy is the origin of it all, and it belongs to a plane which knows no limitation whatsoever. No limitation whatsoever. If an analogy might help, consider it this way. All that we know here and experience from the beginning right up to the supreme state for human beings is just one octave of existence. Just one octave. When, for instance, the yogi says that he is able to enable Shakti to rise up and become one with Sahasrara here, Shiva Shakti are united. All that is the limit of fulfillment and development possible to the human species. But beyond that, that makes one octave. Beyond that are several octaves. We don't know how many. I certainly don't, you see. But I use the term primordial creative energy, meaning the ultimate beginnings. Beginning is a bad word, because space, time and matter all come into being with the Big Bang. Until then, there is no space and time. There is no container before that. There is only the contained. And that is indescribable because of the absence of a container. Therefore, that Big Bang produces the container for this primordial energy, the contained, in order to manifest one octave of universal existence. I don't know whether I'm talking nonsense or whether it conveys anything to you. And when the resurrection means the rising up of the embodied transcendence. That's what it means to me. I don't know whether conventional Catholicism or any other religion would accept that, but that is how it seems to me. These are very difficult questions. Please will you say, this is the next question, please will you say a few words about grace? We all know the ordinary meaning of the word gracious, don't we? A gracious person. Someone who is generous, giving, without being condescending. You see what I mean? Just naturally, spontaneously gives. The giver of good things. And that giving, the giving of good things is grace. And I believe it is in that sense that the religions have talked of the grace of God. In India, the term, both in the Sanskrit and the Pali. In the Sanskrit, one of the Rig Vedic gods is Bhaga. Bhaga is the giver of good things. And you know how the Buddha is called Bhagava, and it is translated as Lord. It's translated as the fortunate one, Bhagava. And he's the giver of good fortune. And the best fortune in Buddhist terms is the receiving through grace of the Dhamma. That is the greatest good fortune. That's about all I can say at the moment, anyway. This is the next one. In your article on death, in the middle way, you say, when the five khanda bundle dies, all the physical atoms composing the body return to the universal stock. All the psychical components likewise return to the aggregates, affecting and influencing the quality and properties of the stock. Could you please tell us at what stage in manifestation the stock first appears? To be quite truthful, I don't know. I haven't come across any calendar which tells me that. But one may imagine that this stock, as far as it concerns human beings, appears when the psychophysical organism comes into being. But when that came into being, the Lord knows. I don't suppose he does even. Because in these contexts, time, what is time in these contexts? We are here, we human beings are responsible for the psychical atmosphere that we have generated through the millennia. We are responsible for that. And we are responsible for the changes which we introduce into the psychical atmosphere. So you see, the question goes on. Is it what you call fundamental substance? And does this stock become the building bricks of the next pulse or the next manifestation? No. If by pulse you are referring to the phrase, the pulse of creation, in its supreme sense, that pulse is always new. It's non-repetitive. People regard the pulse of creation and the production of a new universe somewhat after the fashion of rearranging the furniture in the room. You see what I mean? Using the old stuff. No. Primordial creative activity is totally new all the time. And pulse, I have to use the word pulse because there is no word in the language which can express this without bringing in the feeling of time. The word pulse also brings in the feeling of time. But time as we know it just doesn't exist. This pulse of creation is action in eternity. And when the pulse of creation has released a cosmos, released this cosmos, that is, because the ultimate cosmos is something infinitely beyond all the cosmos that we can examine, observe, and talk about, and so forth. And that ultimate totality really comes into being in eternity, where there is no time. Everything happens immediately. That is the extraordinary part of it. In fact, it is reflected in what scientists have said about the Big Bang. You remember I gave you figures from the initial moment of time, which they call the singularity, within one divided by one with 43 noughts after it of a second, suddenly most of the universe has come into being. Now you see, that's reflected in material terms, but material which is not yet solid or liquid. It is entirely in terms of the subatomic particles and the nuclei of the various chemical elements. So it's very difficult to say anything about questions of this sort, really.